Hi there, my name is Laura V, and I'm from San Francisco, and I'm in recovery from compulsive overeating. Nice to be here. So I do definitely believe in starting with at least a quick qualification so everybody knows they're in the right spot. And to anyone who's a little bit newer, you will eventually hear your story. All our stories have different nuances, but it's the same disease or dis-ease, if you prefer. I don't remember having a lot of, I would say, food focus when I was a small child. I remember eating sugared cereal with my brother, as often as we possibly could. But food didn't really become a major problem for me until I had a trauma at 16 years old. And that's how I chose to dealt with it or to cope with it. I had a boyfriend who was very controlling and scary. And so I went to food and I got really depressed and I just overate. So I developed my full-on binge eating disorder at that time. And it has then, once I made that move, made that decision, then my relationship, if it had ever been abnormal before, I was not sure, but it was clear that it was abnormal then. And it's been, I guess, in on and off a wrestle ever since. I've done a lot of things that a lot of us have done. I've hidden food. Everywhere. I have been socially inappropriate. Like there was some formal event and I've eaten before it was acceptable to do so. I have thrown something away because I didn't want to eat it anymore or didn't think it was a good idea to eat it anymore in the moment and then gone back after it. Various things like that. I have eaten to the point of getting sick. And I've eaten to the point where I woke up in the middle of the night to get sick. So, we're all in this together and you're in good company. Though I wouldn't consider myself a bulimic because the what happened in those instances were an involuntary type of getting sick, but again, it's all variations of the same disease. I think a significant part of the either, I don't know if it's nature or nurture, the eating disorder. I'm not sure if we're born with it or I just don't know all the psychology of it, but I do know that it can often be handed down, and my parents had addictive stuff going on as well as other relatives. I really felt as a child like I didn't have a voice. I grew up in San Francisco in the late 60s, early 70s, and they had the idea of how to integrate the city. It was actually racially integrate. It was actually a really good idea, but those of us who were children sort of, in a way, kind of paid the price for the implementation of the idea, let's say. And my brother and I, so what the idea was they would take all the kids and they would bus them across town to a school that they wouldn't normally go to. And then they would just create this racial mix. And that's one of the reasons why San Francisco did become an integrated city. It was a scary experience for my brother and I. We felt oftentimes, because we were in somebody else's area, we were in another area. So we both experienced maybe what I'll call reverse racism, but it was a scary time. You always had to be on guard. And the environment in which we even lived, there was some violence on a like small kid level. And so when I tried to explain to the adults around me that I was being hurt, they didn't understand what I was saying, but I took that to mean that it didn't matter. And so I had these complex emotions where I felt fear or I felt like I was out of my depth in a situation where I couldn't handle it. And I tried to seek help from the adults around me, but that didn't seem to produce anything other than, you know, why are you telling me this sort of thing? And so I really learned to shut that voice down. And it's, I will say, in many ways, it's still problematic today. I've come a long way. But a lot of times what would happen for me with food is I would be 2 hours behind a binge saying, oh, I must have been upset, you know, and eventually I would realize during a binge, oh, I think I'm upset. But eventually I got to realize before the binge that I was upset. And so when I say I still have difficulty, it's gotten so much better, but sometimes I'm not sure what I'm feeling and I'm not sure how to get to that. You know, something might've happened to hurt my feelings. Something might have produced an emotional response, but I'm kind of like, what was the trigger there? What was the trigger? I will say that in most cases today, in recovery, I don't act on that with food, but I think emotional pain, maybe from youth, is something that a lot of us have in common. And so I've certainly found that to be the case as I speak with others. So I had this fear growing up. I didn't feel like I had a voice, and learned to kind of stuff feelings and deal with that with food. I first time I came into the rooms was about 20 years ago in OA. I wasn't ready then. Our disease is progressive, but I guess my perception, and I'm not sure if my perception was accurate, I can probably lean toward not that accurate, but it seemed too rigid to me. Back then, I feel as if people would let you know what your food plan should be. And that was just really hard for me. I really love the way OA is now, that each person actually comes to identify their triggers, their red, yellow, and green foods, and that you develop your own food plan with the support of your sponsor. I think that's a really important process to go through, to understand, because we have emotional triggers and food triggers, right? So those, to understand those on a deeper level and to be able to develop your plan, I think, is a key component of success. At least that's my opinion. So I left the rooms. I was in for about a year and a half or so, and then I left the rooms and you know, not being present for recovery and learning to work through what they call, of course, life on life's terms, made it, you know, just didn't create an advance and sort of stuck in the same things over and over, which of course we know is the very definition of insanity, doing the same things over and over and expecting different results. But that was my case. And so when I came back into the rooms, which was probably maybe 2 years ago, but I will say in and out, because I had, and this is really an important part of my story, I had four different sponsors who released me, I guess I'll say. The first one, I should have seen that writing on the wall, but she kept saying, if you want to find somebody else, please feel free. And I'm like, no, I'm happy. But when that happened, I left the program for 9 months. Then I came back and a sponsor stopped taking my calls. And then I left for 6 months. And when it happened the third time, an epiphany happened. I asked myself, you know, you could leave again, or you could stay and fight for your recovery. And so, you know, I've come to understand, and I love the tradition that talks about principles over personalities. I think that's really important to keep in mind, because we're all from different walks of life and we struggle oftentimes with our, you know, those relational components. And we all have different ideas about, you know, what should be, but hopefully we, you know, link arms, move through this together, take what we like and leave the rest, or what works for us and leave the rest. And, you know, understand that in sponsorship, It may be a fit for one person and not a good fit for the other person. And that's okay. That's okay. But I have to be willing to fight for my recovery. And that's what I learned the third time this happened. And then it happened a fourth time. And at least, I don't know if this is, so when I came in, I don't think in the past I had a food and a step sponsor, but when I came in this time, and so I thought, oh, OA has just changed in this way. There are food sponsors and there are step sponsors. It never occurred to me that a step sponsor might not be able to hear people's food. That never occurred to me. So I thought this was the way it was done. And so the step sponsors were the ones who continued. And I had a food sponsor who, and have a food sponsor who is just lovely. And after the fourth sponsor said she didn't think it was a good fit, then I asked my food sponsor, I said, would you mind being my step sponsor as well? And she said, I would love to work the steps with you. And so, you know, it'd been great if I just asked her in the beginning, but I just didn't know. So, but it was really important. Again, I just want to reiterate this one last time. It's important for me to fight for my recovery. And so if I have a misunderstanding with a fellow or get my feelings hurt by a fellow in the program, then I work that out to the best of my ability, release it and move forward. But I am here for the long haul. So fighting for recovery is really important. I think a couple of key things happened after I left for 6 months and came back with that second sponsor situation. A key thing happened. I was listening to a phone meeting. It had been recorded earlier that day. And so I heard the speaker. And then after the speaker, there was a Q&A. And somebody had a really interesting question for the speaker, which was, why do you think some people don't succeed in the program? I thought that was a very lofty question to ask another human. But she said, yeah, I'll tell you my thoughts on that. She said, it's the difference between trying to fit the program into your life versus making the program your life. And I just light bulb for me, just light bulb there. And I thought, oh, that's what it is. That's been my struggle. There is a, for today, this really resonated with me when I read it. It's the quote from Hippocrates on July 21st, and it says, extreme remedies are very appropriate for extreme diseases. And so, you know, this is a thing that I have been wrestling with for decades and decades of my life, and it has been overpowering, overwhelming, all of these things. It's sort of like caught in a net that I could never get out. And so how could I possibly think that I could dabble in the solution when, you know, the problem, so to speak, has been so big? And so that was a real epiphany when I heard her response to that question. A second thing that happened almost simultaneously is I wasn't always sticking to my food plan. And my sponsor, we were talking about that. And she asked me a question that I thought was unrelated, which was, do you think it's important to keep your commitments to people? And I said, oh, absolutely. Like, you have to be able to follow through with that stuff. You can't just promise somebody something and then, oh, sorry. Want to do this other thing over here. I mean, you know, that's not really helpful or respectful, or people need to be able to trust what you say. And she said, can you then tell me why you won't keep your commitments to yourself? And that really shocked me. And so I realized in sort of putting myself last that way, or not taking as seriously keeping the commitments that I made to myself, was another one of the issues. I really appreciate in our literature how it says, how it gives us what the spiritual principle is for every step. I love that because I'm a big picture person, and it always helps me so much to have an overview. And so if you know, the spiritual principle is honesty for step one, then that tells me what I'm shooting for, you know? And as I work step one, am I more honest in my life? Am I more honest about my disease? Am I more honest about the way that I live? And so that was key. And then when you're looking at step two, and the spiritual principle is hope, you're like, okay, now that we know what exists, so I've looked at this honestly, and then do I have hope for change? Do I have hope that something could be different here and I can move forward? And then step three, of course, is faith. And it always helps me to think that the opposite of fear is faith. And so am I now living not in fear anymore that, you know, I can't change, but can I have maybe even just a little bit of faith? And if I'm not to the place where I can fully embrace the concept of God or higher power, it does work to, at least temporarily, or maybe, I don't know, ongoing, but to make the group your higher power, because our collective wisdom is stronger than our individual wisdom. And so I love that too. And then you move on for there, courage and, you know, all these other things. And so when I'm keeping this theme in mind as I'm working the steps, it just really helps me to know what I'm aiming for. And finally, I guess, just to get current, I had a really rough 2 weeks, a little over, I guess, almost 2 weeks ago. I had this court date that I, that had to do with my dad passed away in January of this year. And so, we went to this court date. I was with my sister, and it just had to do with something left on his estate or something. And I didn't realize it would trigger me with grief. My dad and I both, I had a complicated relationship with both of my parents, but with my dad, one of the hard things was that I didn't see, because he wasn't very verbally affectionate or really in any other way. But after he passed away, I saw some things in how he tried to communicate value to me that I didn't see before. And then that night, I wanted to sort of comfort myself with like a film, a movie. And I hadn't realized that the movie that I chose, I didn't realize until afterwards, that was my best friend's favorite film. And she died 2.5 years ago of this disease. And so I had this double sort of new wave of grief. And it seemed so intense, and I was just really kind of confused by it. And so I actually ended up, you know, going into, I guess I'll say, a little bit of a dark place. And then it just persisted. I found myself irritable because I didn't fully understand my feelings. And I was talking to a fellow the other day, and actually, yeah, a couple of days ago, I was talking to a fellow in the program, and I realized that I was judging myself for being in grief. I mean, that sounds like a weird thing, but that's why I was so irritated and sort of frustrated at the situation, because I wasn't practicing acceptance around just the emotional state that I was in, because I've already like grieved these people, you know? So I thought it was a thing that was done. But what I do come to understand is that grief can come in waves and layers. So not only did I realize and say, oh, okay. So you're judging yourself now, which whenever we do that, it makes everything 10 to 100 times worse. So I understand that. But I then started to say, okay, I'm going to practice acceptance around here. This is where I'm at. And we're just going to let this thing run its course. We're going to reach out as needed. We're going to follow the tools, and, you know, we're going to do what we're supposed to do. And that has really helped. And then practicing the acceptance. And even today when I got up, and I do think, Cindy, I see that that's running out, but I'll just finish with this story. I didn't understand the whole tool of action planning. And so now what my action plan looks like is I write what's called a Dear God letter, just about how I'm feeling. And then I write my food plan for the day. And then I write a few tools, meeting, service, sponsorship, telephone, writing, and literature. And I put down how I'm going to work those tools today. And I found that to be an incredibly helpful thing. But what one thing I wrote out this morning, which surprised me a little bit, because when I do the Dear God letter, sometimes it's just like, oh, I feel like this, I feel like that, this is difficult, I don't know how to get through this. But more often than not now, it's how grateful I am, which is quite the switch. But this morning, I found myself writing that I'm so glad that a process exists for dealing with grief. Because what would we do? And so I'll close with this. I really have been so moved, and even there have been pockets of joy in recovery. And I feel like, you know, God said, humans, you need more help. I'm going to give you 12-step programs and dogs. And with that, I close. Thank you.